Welcome back to the second hour of Guitar Tracks. I'm your host, Brian Tarquin. For those of you who are not familiar with Will Ray, he is a guitarist from the Helicasters, and they were an all-guitar instrumental band, and he uses this thing called the B-Bender, which makes it sound like a slide. I've had him as a guest guitarist on my solo albums, and it always turns out great. So he tells me how he got started playing guitar.
Well, I started playing in high school a little bit, but kind of gave it up when I went in the Army. And when I got out of the Army, what really got me into it again was listening to the Grateful Dead. And my brother brought home a first Live Dead album, and boy, I was really hooked at that point, you know, with Jerry Garcia and everything. From that moment on, something clicked in me, and that's what I wanted to do. Devoted 8 hours a day to just learning guitar. My biggest influences would probably be Jerry Garcia, Peter Frampton when he was with Humble Pie, and also Mike Bloomfield when he was with Paul Butterfield. Those are probably my three biggest influences on guitar. Late 70s, I was in some country rock bands in Richmond, Virginia, and I got a hold of something that Clarence White was playing on, but I didn't realize he was using a B-Bender on it. It was an Earl of Guthrie album, I think it was called Running Down the Road. And that just baffled me. And so at that point, I started experimenting with these like ring slides that I keep on my fingers. And like I just kept progressing. And I thought, well, I can't play like him, but you know, I've got some cool new licks that I've made up with the slide rings and stuff. Then years later, I got a B-Bender and all his stuff kind of fell into place. It's like, wow, I get it now.
I think all of us guitarists can relate to that when we finally get it, what another player had been influencing us all this time. Now Will explains how he formed the Helicasters in that club on Lancashire in North Hollywood, the Palomino.
Well, I moved to L.A. in 1983, and it took me about 7 years, I think, to really, I always call it the 7 year plan. When you move to a new city, it takes you about 7 years to get connected and work your way into the scene and everything. And so by 1990, I had known John Jorgensen and Jerry Donahue, and I remember Jerry Donahue and I were sitting in the Palomino Club, and we were at one of these Ronnie Mack barn dances. We said, you know, we ought to do one of these barn dances, just do hot dog around, do some instrumental stuff, you know, just play guitar. Yeah, that'd be cool. We should get a third guy. John's name came up. So that's when the Helicaster started, was about 1990. And from that point on, I feel like I became more connected. My career was more on an upswing than a downswing, you know. Also in 1990, we refied the house in Burbank, California, and I got a loan to start my own 16-track studio. You know, I kind of started with 4 tracks, then I went to 8 tracks, then I went to 16-track analog. And then after that, I think around 2000 or so, I went to another 16 tracks of digital plus analog. And then I think in 2004, I went totally to Pro Tools. By owning my own studio, I could make a lot more money than I could just waiting around for the phone to ring on other sessions and stuff. So I just kind of produced a lot of local artists at that point and kind of hired myself to play guitar, do background vocals and stuff like that. That was kind of fun. I had everything that I needed to make good quality recording. All of the Helicaster stuff, first couple of songs we recorded, I recorded on my 16-track Fostex machine. And then eventually those 2 songs, I think, made it onto the first album. And then the way the Helicasters work is we would just kind of go into the studio, do basics, get the bass and the drums down, and then whoever song it was would do their part so the other guys could match up with it. And then we would just, everybody bounce the stuff down to whatever format we were on. Jerry and I both had Fostex machines that ran at 30 inches per second, you know, 30 IPS. We would swap the tapes back and forth, and John would just, at first, I think he'd just book a 24-track studio, because that's what the original masters were on. At the end, lay everything back in, sync it up, you know, with Synthi code, and basically that's the way we did parts. We never did our own parts when the other guys were in the studio, because I don't think you get your best stuff when you're looking at a clock all the time. All of our albums, the guitar parts, for the most part, were mostly done at our home studios in the comfort of our homes at our own pace. Well, Steve Duncan's always been our drummer, and Dennis Belfield, he was our first bass player, and then we just had some other bass players after that. You got to keep in mind, when you live in L.A. and you're a full-time musician, you play in more than one band at a time. And I got to where I could juggle 5 original projects at one time, plus 3 bar bands. And you were always struggling. It was like we were always trying hard. Every original band I was in, you know, we're trying to get record people to come down, trying to drum up support. And it was like trying to push a noodle uphill or something. The Helicasters, things just fell in our lap. Like, we did our first show at the Palomino just for fun. We weren't expecting to ever do another show. Guitar players came out of the woodwork for it. And we decided, well, shoot, you know, it went over so well, let's do another show. So 6 months later, John Jorgensen at the time was playing in the Desert Rose Band, and Jerry was spending a lot of time in England. So, you know, it was hard to line up shows. So second show, we played, and we had an endorsement from G&L Guitars by our second show. By the third show, Michael Nesmith from the Monkees, he came down and he was saying, hey, I'm starting a new label. You guys want to record for me, you know, be on my label? And so things just kind of fell into our lap. What I learned from that was that your energy is more important than all the effort that you're trying to put into something. You know, it's like when you're doing stuff for the right reasons, things come your way more. And so the Helicasters, that's how our record deal came about. It's fairly easy, you know, compared with all the other projects I've been in. They were just hard. You know, we were always spinning our wheels, not getting anywhere. But with the Helicasters, you know, things just happened magically. I think when we went to Magnolia Sound, I think that's where we recorded the first one. We did basics. We recorded on 2-inch, 24-track format, 30 IPS. And then we, from there, bounced things down to our individual formats and stuff. So Jerry and I would swap tapes around, like I said, you know, the 16-track analog tapes. And John would just book studio time when he had the time and just work on his parts. And then in the end, we just kind of bounced everything back. We'd always be surprised at what the other guys would come up with, because it was never like if you wrote a song, the other guys played solos. You didn't get to hear it until the end when you were bouncing everything back. And we had the luxury of time on our side and the luxury of using our home studios. By the second and third album, John had his own studio at his house. And so we all three at that point just worked in our home studios. That's the only way we could really do it. Because if we were in the studio with the other two, you'd do a crappy solo and one of the others might say, oh, I like that. And the other one go, well, you know, let's save that and do another one. And you know, you would just never get anything done. We kind of had full reign, you know. Michael, he owned the label, so we did the first two albums on his label. The first album was called Return of the Helicasters. You'd think that would be the second album, but it's not. It's the first album. Second album, which was Escape from Hollywood. Michael Nesmith, he's very astute. He owned the North American rights to Ken Burns' Civil War series. I'll say this about Michael Nesmith. He was nice enough to give us back the rights to the first two albums. And so then we started our own label, and we became incorporated, and we just started releasing our own material at that point. You know? We did three albums, plus we did sort of a greatest hit, you know, the best of the Helicasters or something. We released Live in Germany DVDs. The Helicasters was about a 10-year endeavor. Started in 1990. By 2000, we were pretty much no longer recording or touring or anything. We just were all involved in our own different projects at that point. You got to keep in mind, in 1990, at that time, I was 40 years old. John was a little younger, and Jerry was a little older. Our first tour was in England, the UK, and it was a hard tour because we had to kind of tour like a baby band. We toured off and on for about almost 10 years, and by touring, we'd go out for 3 weeks at a time, then it became like 2 weeks at a time. Then it became like 10 days at a time. That's as long as we could do it and for it to still be kind of fun. After a while, it's like you have a love-hate relationship with stuff. When you're doing something you love and you're self-employed, it's like there's a certain amount of work you got to do to keep the money coming in. There's got to be enough of a fun factor for you to be doing it, or what's the point of doing something you love if you don't love it? I think after about 10 years, it just quit being fun for everybody. And we all had other things we wanted to do.
Like with all bands, there's always a beginning, middle, and an end. And finally, nobody can stand each other, so they all go their separate ways. Now Will explains how he left L.A. and went to North Carolina to concentrate on his solo career and a slower lifestyle.
At that point, I would say I concentrated more on my solo career. And eventually, you just get to a point where you're comfortable. And you go, you know, I feel pretty good about where I am. So you don't work as hard. At least I don't. I tend to get a little bit lazy. I've got two albums basically recorded. I'm too lazy to make the time and sit down and mix them. I just need to carve out the time and do it. And it's just so hard to do. When it's a pretty day outside, it's like, I want to sit out on my porch and play. Yeah. I moved back to the East Coast in 2005. LA's kind of a young person's town. After a while, the traffic and the quality of the air and the lifestyle, you're limited as to what you can buy with the money you make in terms of a home. We had scouted out Asheville, North Carolina, you know, a few years before. And so my wife and I moved. We moved here in 2005. I kind of missed the South. South has kind of a lazy style about it that I like. Thought I would be recording a lot of local people, but what I found when I moved here is all the musicians are broke out here. Nobody has money. I just more or less use the studio for my own recording. I've just kind of slowed down over the years. I'm more or less semi-retired. I play about once a week out here. I'm in a band called the Space Cooties. We play on Thursday nights out in Asheville, a place called the Asheville Guitar Bar. And that's enough playing for me. You know, I still do projects from time to time. in my studio, long distance, you know, people send me stuff. I think one of the last things I've done was Arlen Roth. He has a new album out. It's called Telemasters. He's playing with a lot of people, Brad Paisley, Vince Gill, Steve Warner, Albert Lee, Steve Cropper, Joe Bonamassa, Johnny Hyland. You know, I'm on there, and Brent Mason, Bill Curtin, Red Volkart, Jerry Donahue. I think probably one of the last things Jerry did before his stroke.
Well, Will is with a lot of great company on that Arlen Roth CD, so he hasn't quite slowed down all the way yet. Now I wanted to concentrate on the gear, because all of us guitarists are just complete gear nuts. So he explains what he has.
Guitars, a bunch of amps. Lately, I've been using my signature model G&L guitars. Let's see, I've been playing through. I like Vox amps, the newer modeling types. So I've got a VT 40 plus. It's about a 40 watt amp with a 10 inch speaker. Yeah, it sounds pretty good. You know, I just kind of keep it on one setting the whole night and just use pedals to change up my sound. And I like using organ pedals. I use a Boss compressor, use a Tube Screamer, and I have a Boss Auto Wah. And that's about it. In the Helicasters, we first started out with an endorsement from Matchless Amps. They were Mark Sampson era. Mark really, you know, he has a lot of good ideas on it. But eventually I kind of drifted into Rivera amps. Probably, if it, you know, if I had to do battle on stage, go toe-to-toe with heavy-duty cats, I'd probably use a Rivera. They're good, you know, they're tube-based amps, and they're very punchy. You can get a good, clean sound out of it and put a little hair on it. Generally, the Helicasters, we all kind of had the same philosophy about amps, and that was the loudest, cleanest amp you can, and then use your pedals to color it. All three of us had pedal boards that we used. We weren't really into rack mount stuff. We like our pedals. We like our good, clean amps. You know, if you have a good, clean amp, you can play almost at any volume. You know, you can just use your distortion pedals to put a little overdrive and hair on it, you know. And that way you can play at literally any kind of volume and still get a pretty good sound. For some reason, none of us like saturation channels on amp. We're big fans of that kind of distortion that comes from overdriving within the amp. We like to use pedals to hit the preamp stage of an amp. We were playing through basically 30 watt matchless amp. A 30 watt matchless amp is like a 50 or 60 watt, you know, regular amp. I still play the G&Ls because I just think they're the best guitar for the money that you can get. When Leo Fender, when he left Fender Guitars, he still had a lot of good ideas. And with G&L, that was the last company that he was associated with when he died. And, you know, I think he came up with a number of improvements to guitar. Like, I like the Z-coil pickups. That was one of the last type pickups he invented. And the Z-coils are, it's like two, instead of single coil, two coils being side by side, they're kind of staggered a little bit. And by doing that, one coil handles three strings and the other coil handles the other three strings. You don't get that typical humbucker muddiness, you know. It keeps things really crystal clear. Plus, you get good output from it. And I like my signature models. I still have my signature models, and I usually will play a different model of mine. I'll play it for about a month down at the guitar bar on Thursday nights, you know, just to kind of keep the guitars going, keep them in good shape, and keep me kind of satisfied with playing and everything. Because for a while I was just into cigar box guitars, but I spent about 10 years just playing those. Arlen Roth, everybody else is holding Telecasters. I'm holding a cigar box guitar that was built from Telecaster parts. John and I started on G&L. Jerry's always been a Fender guy, and he had his own signature model at the time with Fender when the Telecaster got going. In 1996, we signed a 5-year contract with Fender, and so Fender started making signature models on both of us, on all three of us. They were already making them for Jerry. They made a special limited edition Telecasters model that was made in Japan. And then they started making individual models in the custom shop. I went back to G&L. That was around 2001. I just kind of missed G&L guitars. Then we started doing a Will Ray signature model with G&L.
That's quite an honor to get a signature series guitar made by a manufacturer like Fender and G&L. I remember it was very difficult to get endorsements. I actually was endorsed by Fender, too. We then had a very interesting conversation about artist royalties.
First album, I think we had 13 or 14 songs on it. And we learned from the first album that record companies will only pay you for up to 10 songs. And so if you do cover songs, you're not going to make any money because they're going to have to pay the royalties to the songwriters of those songs. You know, the music business is, it's close to being like the mob or something. You know, there's so many ways that artists kind of get screwed. It's a shame it's that way. And you'd think it would change over the years, but it just seems to get worse and worse. The biggest complaint I hear now with artists is how little they get because of streaming. It's like in the old days, you'd get 6 cents on a song, let's say, if it was on an album. Well, those days are over because nobody's even buying CDs anymore. They're not buying MP3s. I looked at my royalty statement. It was like, I don't know, 25 pages long. And it was just lists of 2 cents. Once I had a song played, it was played during the quarter reporting period. It was played 500,000 times. And I got like $38 from it or something. It's where the music business is. I'm lucky to have lived through, I think, more of a heyday of music. You know, music's always been pretty good to me, but I've also been pretty resourceful. What I would tell young people today is you got to be resourceful. You got to figure out how you can do what you love and make money with it. And that's kind of the way it's always been. I figured it out as much as I need to. I still make enough money in music to basically say I'm still a full-time musician, even though I'm not a full-time musician in that all I do is music, but really, it's just sliding by quite a bit of the time. You know, the moment record companies started going downhill, when Napster came along, because at that point, music was digital, but the record companies didn't get it. It was kind of like when IBM confronted by Bill Gates and said, well, all I want is software. What money can be made with software? We want to make the hardware. And that's the way the record companies are. Who wants this stuff called MP3? When streaming came along, musicians just seemed to lose on these kind of deals. But, you know, musicians have to just be resourceful, and they've got to figure out, well, how can I make money? when you look at a typical recording contract, it's so skewered toward the record company. I mean, you have to have legal representation if you're going to sign something now. The smart artists own their own material, they own their own rights to it, and they'll just license it to a record company. And older musicians have to figure out how to retool and how to get their product out there in the hands of other people. You know, how to make money with what you do as an artist, you know, with your art. And that's the challenge. And every year you have to retool a little bit and just you have to sniff out where the money can be without sacrificing your ideals.
Man, he is preaching to the choir when he talks to me about that. I know all about artist royalties. In fact, I wrote a few published books about them just so artists could be aware of how they can make money. So here's the Helicasters with Axe to Grind. We'll be right back. We had a lot of fun on that song. That's La Noche Triste, featuring Will Ray and myself from Orlando in Heaven, Brian Tarquin and Company. Before that was Highlander Boogie by Will Ray and the Helicasters.